This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It was an attack on the center of American government, the United States Capitol. Those are the sounds of the mob of Trump supporters, thousands of them, as they entered the Capitol building yesterday to try to stop Congress from certifying the presidential election. Four people died. More than a dozen were injured, including Capitol Police. Arrests number in the dozens, but only a fraction of the people who took part. And insurrectionists ransacked many of the offices inside. President Trump, who earlier had told them to march to the Capitol, called them great patriots. Once law enforcement did get control of the situation, Congress came back and they finished the certification that Joe Biden won. Well, today, Trump issued a statement saying there would be an orderly transition. But now there are calls to remove the president from office with less than 2 weeks to go. Congresswoman Karen Bass represents parts of West and South L.A. She had that scary front row seat to much of what happened yesterday, and she's with us right now. Congresswoman, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
What was that experience like for you? I mean, were you on the floor when the mob entered the Capitol?
Well, I was on the floor, but I left about 5 minutes before the mob broke through. And I will tell you, it was a sad day to begin with, because knowing that my Republican colleagues were actually going to challenge the results of the election was sad in and of itself, especially where they were making the challenges. So the day began like that. But one thing that I felt for sure was that I was in the safest place in America. And I told my family that. I told my family that I was worried about the protesters being there, because 3 weeks ago when there was a Trump rally, four people were stabbed. We know that every time he has a rally, especially where he's going to speak, he's going to gin everybody up. He doesn't care about the health of his own supporters, so they're going to be a super spreader event. And that I anticipated that there would be violence, but I never imagined the violence would be inside the halls of the Capitol.
You have called for everyone who broke into the Capitol yesterday to be found and arrested.
Exactly.
Dozens have been arrested, but and some are due actually in court today. What charges do you want to see brought? I mean, I suspect these are federal crimes, right?
At a minimum, it's trespassing. Now, I am not a lawyer, so I can't decide. But vandalism, the trespassing, the violence that occurred in terms of the fights that broke out, not following the orders of a police officer, assault against a police officer. It's all on camera. They felt that they could operate with complete impunity, which is why they even took selfies of themselves, standing on the statues, taking down an American flag to put up a Trump flag. I mean, all sorts of crimes were committed here, outside and inside of the Capitol, and it's all on video. And so I want the police to do their job, just like there would if this had been a group of Black Lives Matter protesters. Then they would be looking at the photographs and going after people. And that's exactly what they should do. Breaking in and vandalizing Pelosi's office. The guy that did that has posted a picture of himself with his name and said he has no regrets. That man should be arrested. There needs to be one standard of justice here.
He said that he probably will see a violent death. He actually posted that as well, saying that, you know, that, and he's okay with that.
The sad thing is that our president has become a cult leader, and these people that follow him are like in a cult. If he tells them to jump off a bridge, they will ask him how high. I mean, and that's what you saw yesterday. But when they interviewed people walking down the street, they were saying, well, you know, we think this is going to change and he's going to follow us there. And he has some surprise for us and we don't know what it is. It was so sad to see people that would be so gullible. And he uses them. He's raising money off of them. He's getting them to contribute money that he's basically going to use for his own personal reasons.
I want to talk a little bit about that double standard that you mentioned, because President-elect Biden mentioned that today in going back and forth with a message from his granddaughter. Let's hear a little bit of that.
She sent me a photo of military people in full military gear, scores of them lining the steps of the Lincoln Memorial because of protests by Black Lives Matter. She said, "Pop, this isn't fair. No one can tell me that if had been a group of Black Lives Matter protesting yesterday, they wouldn't have been treated very, very differently."
Why weren't, I'm curious, Congresswoman, because we see videos that it appears, and again, there's no firm evidence, that Capitol Police just sort of gave up or you know,
exactly,
let a lot of these protesters in. So you're somebody who works inside that building. How, you know, what kind of investigation will come from that?
Well, I certainly think there needs to be a comprehensive investigation. I know in talking to members of the Capitol Police, they told me that they were just completely overwhelmed because I said, why hasn't there been mass arrests? And they basically said they couldn't arrest the people because they didn't have enough troops here. Now, apparently, there's a couple of thousand members of the Capitol Police Department. There were only 500 on duty yesterday. Why wasn't everybody here? Why wasn't there a full court press, knowing what happens at a Trump event and knowing that he was going to speak there? So I do think that there should be an investigation. And, I think there were about 50 people arrested, but there were tens of thousands of people here on the grounds and a couple of thousand running through the buildings. How do you only arrest 50 people? And I didn't see anybody being arrested in the Capitol. They were arrested afterwards. So this was just a failure overall.
Articles of impeachment are being drawn up today, right, against the president to have him removed. Chuck Schumer said that this is the Senate Democratic leader, the minority leader for now, about to be majority leader, is calling for the president to be removed via the 25th Amendment. How far do you take that?
Well, let me just tell you, I would love to see this presidency end today, because I worry about our country over the next 13 days. I would, if it could happen via the 25th Amendment, if it could happen via impeachment, that would be fine. At this point in time, though, I just don't have the confidence in my colleagues over in the Senate who voted to who disagreed with accepting the election last night, that all of a sudden today they're going to vote for impeachment.
Some Republican members of Congress who had planned to object to President-elect Biden's certification changed their minds after what happened at the Capitol yesterday. Only a handful of senators ended up objecting, but we're talking dozens, more than 100. The New York Times says 147 of your Republican colleagues in the House voted to object on one of the fronts, including some here in California. Do you blame lawmakers on the other side of the aisle who have supported the president's accusations that the election was rigged for what happened yesterday?
Well, no, I blame the president of the United States, period. And any of my Republican colleagues that were complicit, I mean, a couple of them were on the floor last night actually saying maybe they weren't Trump supporters. Maybe it was Antifa, that the president was not responsible. The president actually tried to bring about calm. Those members are complicit. Other members had dignity, like Adam Kinzinger, Kathleen McMorris Rogers. They were horrified by what happened, and they took a public stand against it, and I commend them.
We asked our listeners, Congresswoman, how they were feeling after the events yesterday on Capitol Hill. And one listener, Mark Wills, wrote, and I'm quoting here, I'm scared that our beloved democracy, he says, is so close to being extinguished from the planet. What comes next from leadership? That's heartbreaking, by the way.
It absolutely is heartbreaking. And I think if we can survive these next 13 days, again, I would love for him to be gone today, and then we wouldn't have to worry about our survival. And I am hoping that once this man is off the stage, that we will be able to govern in this institution. And I am just so glad that yesterday, the news that, of course, was overshadowed by the rioting was the fact that Democrats will now be in control of the Senate, which means that those 200 bills bipartisan bills that have been languishing on Mitch McConnell's desk can actually make it to President Biden's desk.
Well, we're glad you're safe. We're glad that members of Congress and are safe. We're heartbroken by what happened yesterday and the loss of life and the bloodshed. Obviously, the stain on our democracy for sure. Congresswoman Karen Bass, who represents parts of West and South LA, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Well, there is bipartisan outrage over what happened at the U.S. Capitol yesterday, but there are some Republicans who continue to be steadfast in their unfounded claims that the election was rigged. And that means a fissure at the GOP that's been open since Donald Trump's nomination in 2016 is growing even wider. What does that mean going forward for the Republican Party? Well, Dan Schnur is a professor of politics and communications at USC. He's a former Republican strategist as well. Dan, welcome back to you.
Steve, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
After the mob was cleared out and Congress finally got down to certifying the election results, more than 100 Republican members of the House still voted against. They still objected. There are 11 Republican members of the House of Representatives from California. How did they vote? How many of them voted to certify the Electoral College votes for Joe Biden?
It shouldn't be surprising, given the numbers that you just cited, that only two California Republican House members voted to support the Electoral College decision. In fairness, two other members did not vote. Both had been delayed their trip to Washington for COVID-related reasons. But seven out of the nine California Republicans who did vote affirmatively to overturn the Electoral College results.
What are the political ramifications? I mean, in California, I think the conventional wisdom has been in California, Republicans are a little further to the left than the hard right in other parts of the country. What's the dance that they have to do in the state?
Well, it's a very, very delicate dance. One, it's worth remembering that while California has, of course, become a deep blue state over the years, the remaining Republican bastions, for the most part, tend to be very conservative. So most of the Republican House members who voted in favor of the motions yesterday against the Electoral College are probably not going to be that endangered in any future election. But as you and your listeners know, just back in November, four Republicans won back House seats in California that are relatively contested. Of those four, one of the four, Young Kim, voted against the motion to overturn the Electoral College, clearly concerned about a general election challenge in 2 years, or next year, actually. Mike Garcia, the Republican just elected up in Ventura County, voted to overturn. He already is facing a general election challenge from the candidate he beat in November, Christy Smith. So this will be a major talking point in that race. And then the other two Republicans who were just elected, David Valdeo up in the Central Valley and Michelle Steele in Orange County, neither of them were able to vote for COVID-related reasons. But Young Kim voting with the Electoral College, Mike Garcia voting against, were the notable decisions there.
So it is a tight wire, you know, a dance, as you say. We do, Dan, have a growing problem, though, right? Apparently, your political point of view determines what you believe. A good many Republicans believe the election was stolen, all evidence to the contrary. I keep seeing in conservative media today this unfounded claim that Antifa was behind yesterday's Capitol attack. And again, all evidence to the contrary. How sustainable is this for one of America's two major political parties?
Well, the key word in that question is the word two major political parties. For many, many years, people have asked me about the prospects of a viable third party in the United States, and I've always been very dismissive of it for all sorts of reasons. But I wonder if the Republican Party is edging closer to, as Ronald Reagan once said, a time for choosing. Between those members, a significant plurality, about 40% of Republicans in the House yesterday, voted against the motions to overturn the Electoral College. Whether a more traditional Republican Party remains on one side and a more pro-Trump party emerges as well. I'm not yet ready one day later to predict that the Republican Party will split into two officially rather than just psychologically. But I think it's more likely now than at any time in modern American political history.
Well, this isn't one day later, though. I mean, we've seen this coming. I mean, over the course of 4 years, you see people just, I mean, have been flocking to him because they know his popularity. And you know, again, with him out of the White House, presumably in 13 days, maybe even sooner, if some Democrats and House members have their way on Capitol Hill today, what is the Trump effect on the Republican Party going forward?
Well, we don't know. And your point is exactly right. You know, what happened yesterday was the continuation, perhaps the exacerbation of trends that have been developing over the course of 4 years, if not longer, for Trump and his supporters in the broader Republican Party. But I'll say this, during the time between Congress recessing because of the mob violence and coming back in last night, roughly half of the Republican senators who were going to vote in favor of the investigation that Ted Cruz had called for, in other words, voting against the Electoral College, changed their mind. And so what was already a stark choice before yesterday between what we'll call pro-Trump Republicans on one hand and pre-Trump Republicans on the other, that line became a lot starker yesterday. And so I think the potential for a more formal split into two separate parties is considerably greater than it was 24 hours ago.
Why can't we even agree on facts, though, Dan? It's the confirmation bias thing, right? I want my opinions to be confirmed on whatever media outlet is available. Is it a breakdown, do you think, of trust in the mainstream media that's been propagated by, you know, talk radio, right-wing talk radio over the past 30 years?
I think that's part of it. I would point to talk radio, I'd point to cable television, and I'd point to online and social media. Years and years ago, Nick Kristof, the New York Times columnist, wrote a column, and this was at the dawn of the internet era, long before Facebook or Twitter. He wrote a phenomenal column called The Me Network. And his point was that for all the benefits, the considerable benefits of advances in communications technology, it's also allowed each one of us to create our own media environment. And my argument, not his, is the impact of that, of our self-selected media environment, whether it's driven by Fox or MSNBC, whether it's driven by The Daily Caller or by Pod Save America. Either way, it allows all of us to exist very comfortably in an ideological igloo in which we're never criticized, we're never challenged. We merely have our opinions reaffirmed and we're congratulated for having them. And the ultimate outcome is the one that you just pointed to. We construct not just our own media environment, but our own reality.
Dan Schnur, professor of politics and communications over at USC and a former Republican strategist. Dan, as always, thanks for your time.
You're great to have me. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. As if all the political insanity in Washington isn't enough, COVID-19 is still wreaking havoc here in the Golden State.
COVID-19 is now sending so many people to the hospital in California, there are no more intensive care unit beds open here at Harbor UCLA Medical Center.
Now, just in LA alone, there are more than 8,000 people hospitalized with COVID, and that number is on the rise. All ICU beds, as you heard, are filled. And if that doesn't spell crisis, then maybe it's the fact that ambulances are in such short supply that the people who oversee them have modified who should get top priority, which, of course, leads to a lot of questions and confusion. Well, we're here to answer those questions and to set the record straight. Dr. Denise Whitfield is the Director of Education and Innovation at the LA County Emergency Medical Services Agency. And she's with us right now. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
An LA Times headline raised some eyebrows this week. It certainly raised mine. It said, quote, ambulance crews told not to transport patients who have little chance of survival. your agency issued a couple of new directives this week. One of them deals with adults under cardiac arrest. It says ambulance staff should not transport those people to a hospital if they cannot be resuscitated on the scene. Would you explain that to us? And what was the standard of care before?
So in standard policies, when we manage cardiac arrest, the standard of care is to resuscitate a person at the site where the ambulance responds. So patients have the best chance of survival if we can get a pulse back early on. If a resuscitation goes a long period of time and there is no pulse prior to transport, those patients have virtually minimal chances of survival. And so that's really the standard of care across the nation and what was done before COVID. What this policy does with this directive basically reiterates what we have recommended prior to the COVID pandemic, such that our resources can be focused for other patients and our EMS system does not get further overwhelmed.
I mean, clearly we're in a situation where things are really bad. Do you feel like we don't have enough ambulances, or ambulances are being held up at hospitals because those hospitals are also just, you know, filled to the brim?
Yes, absolutely. So our EMS system is under a tremendous amount of stress. Our what are called ambulance patient offload times, or the amount of time that EMS has to wait at the hospital to offload their patient, those have increased. And because of the EMS system is being all of our paramedics, EMTs are having to stay at the hospital, that's decreases the time where they're actually able to be in the field and increases the amount of time it takes for a patient to get an ambulance when they do call 911.
Earlier this week, we spoke to the CEO of Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital, and she said that her facility is preparing for what they call crisis care. What, you know, this is making healthcare decisions based on the entire population rather than just the individual patient. And are these directives that we're hearing from you guys an example of that? Basically saying, hey, these people are not likely to survive. As horrifying as this sounds, right? These people are not likely to survive, and we need that bed for someone else.
In this particular scenario, we are talking specifically about patients that are in cardiac arrest that have not regained a pulse. And so that's a little bit different than crisis standards of care, where we're limiting care on our normal standard.
This is not rationing care. I mean, you are saying we need this ambulance for somebody else, though, right?
That's correct. And so what we're saying is that for patients that have virtually no chance of survival, that those patients shouldn't be transported, thereby opening that ambulance for a patient that would have a chance for survival.
The other directive ordered by the EMS agency deals with oxygen use, which is in obviously very high demand right now. It says, given the acute need to conserve supplies, EMS should only administer supplemental oxygen to patients if their saturation levels are below 90%. Again, break that down for us. What is it normally? How is it different than the standard level of care?
Standardly, there are many indications where an EMS provider might administer oxygen to a patient. Now with the COVID pandemic, because most of the patients that we're transporting and that we're treating at the hospital, they require oxygen for treatment of COVID. And so oxygen has become a limited resource. What this is doing is really conserving oxygen so that we have enough to manage people with an acute need for oxygen.
You're a doctor and you're an Angeleno. Have you ever seen anything like this? And how are you doing right now?
In my career, and I've been an emergency medicine physician for over a decade, I have not seen anything like this before, where our healthcare system is under a tremendous amount of stress. For me, working shifts in the emergency departments as well, it is really something that none of us have seen before. Physicians, nurses across the board that are dealing with these critical patients. And so we will fight every day to do the best for every patient that we encounter.
Dr. Denise Whitfield, the Director of Education and Innovation over at the LA County Emergency Medical Services Agency, the EMS. Doctor, thank you for your time, and Godspeed to you and to everybody who's trying to help in this fight.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us today. Again, what a week. Please stay safe. Next week, our series on waste kicks off with a focus on all that plastic that we use. Turns out when people tell you to throw something away, there's no such place as away. A weeks-long series starts next week right here on Greater LA. We are online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Join your friends and neighbors and subscribe to the podcast. Every episode delivered fresh to your feed so you don't miss a thing. kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Tell us how you're doing. After all the anxiety, the heartbreaking events of this week in Washington, the COVID crisis, there's a lot to talk about. And a lot of folks are sharing thoughts on what happened in D.C. at our Twitter and Facebook page as well. That's at KCRW. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, P.J. Shahamat, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Tom, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and for your time. Have a great night.